Chapter 5. Divine Sparks and Pixie Dust. Revolutionary ideas and revolutionary technologies often advance together. Experimenting with his pea plants, Gregor Mendel could hardly have imagined the complexity of calculations computers would make possible a century later. Watson, Crick, Franklin, and Wilkins could never have uncovered the double helix structure of DNA without X-ray photography and the microscope. Fred Sanger, Alan Colson, Leroy Hood, and others could never have invented genome sequencing without the microprocessor. The army of researchers around the world striving to better understand the human genome would be nowhere without their complex algorithms and advanced processing chips. This tango between our co-evolving tools and ideas is also forever shifting our sense of ourselves as a species. While our ancestors may have seen themselves as the love children of divine sparks and pixie dust, many of us today see ourselves as the output of code. We have given a language to our machines that's become a metaphor for the inner workings of ourselves. It's not just a scientific leap, but also a conceptual one. After billions of years of Darwinian evolution by random mutation and natural selection, this shift enables us to envision a future when we will start not only selecting our future children, but also hacking and writing their genetic code. As soon as scientists began unlocking the mysteries of the genome, they began imagining how changes could be made. In the 1960s, they started using radiation to spur random genetic mutations in simple organisms and plants, a slow, expensive, imprecise, and painstaking process. For every desired mutation found, there could be hundreds, thousands, or even millions of inconsequential or harmful ones. Figuring out in the 1980s and 90s how to more precisely splice genes from one organism to another was a big step forward, but the hunt was still on for a better, faster, and more targeted way of altering genes. More recently, this process has shifted into overdrive. In an important 2009 study, American geneticists Aaron Gertz and Howard Jacob detailed how a class of proteins called zinc finger nucleases, or ZFN, designed to bind to DNA, could be used to precisely edit genomes. With ZFN, proteins are painstakingly engineered to bind and create double-strand breaks to DNA in a specific place. If we imagine the DNA helix as a twisting ladder, ZFN cuts the part where you hold your hands when climbing. This technology was soon used to edit the genomes of mice, rats, cows, pigs, and other non-human mammals in all sorts of laboratory experiments with far greater precision than ever before. ZFN quickly became the predominant gene editing technology in research labs around the world. Its predominance didn't last long. In 2011, an even more convenient gene editing tool was discovered. Transcription activator-like effector nucleases, or TALENs, was yet another obscurely named but revolutionary tool. TALENs also made double cuts to the DNA ladder, but was more flexible and versatile than ZFN, and could be used to edit a broader range of genetic target sites with greater specificity. In those ancient times of just a few years ago, TALENs seemed like magic. It was used to model multiple human diseases more efficiently and effectively, and to create genome-edited mice, cattle, pigs, goats, sheep, and even monkeys. As the process improved, it was used to eliminate a genetic eye disease in mice, and its prospects for helping cure human diseases seemed extremely promising. Recognizing its significance, the influential journal Nature Methods named TALENs its Method of the Year 2011. But while TALENs was easier to use than ZFN and seemed relatively super fast at the time, it too was nothing compared to the world-changing gene editing tool in the making for a quarter of a century, or billions of years, depending on how you're counting, but racing around the corner. This new tool begins among the smallest of organisms. Bacteria are one of the earliest life forms on Earth, and the ultimate survivors. Viruses have been attacking bacteria for more than a billion years in their never-ending quest to find hosts into which to insert a tiny package of viral DNA. The viruses aren't doing this out of malice, hijacking and transforming host cells into tiny virus-producing machines is the virus's sole strategy for survival. The viruses are aggressive, but the bacteria wouldn't have thrived for so long if they didn't build their own defensive survival strategy along the way. In 1987, researchers from Japan's Osaka University, examining a sequence of chromosomal DNA, observed a series of genetic code repeats in a series of code clusters. A couple of years later, a young Spanish researcher named Francisco Mojica, who was studying sequenced bacteria with extreme salt tolerance, kept seeing the same types of repeated clusters of palindromic, for example, madam my madam, code popping up in the bacterial DNA. When Mojica compared the sequences he'd uncovered with those other researchers had placed in the common GenBank database, he began to notice that the bacteria's palindromic repeated code clusters matched some of the same code clusters in certain viruses. At that time, no one knew what these clusters of code were for or if they were even important. Mojica and other researchers like Gilles Vergniaud and Alexander Bulletin in France, however, made a series of brilliant educated guesses that the bacteria were using the code repeats as some type of immune system. A Dutch researcher, Ruud Janssen, later named these sequences clustered, regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats. The name was a mouthful, so he shortened it into the more user-friendly acronym CRISPR. Around the same time, scientists at Danisco, the largest yogurt company in the world, learned about Bulletin's work. Because the Streptococcus thermophilus bacteria is a mainstay in the process of turning milk into yogurt, Danisco scientists Philippe Horvath and Rodolphe Berengu started wondering if understanding how that bacteria responded to a viral attack might suggest new ways of preventing their yogurt and cheese cultures from occasional collapse. Using the lessons learned from Mojica, Bulletin, and others, Horvath and Berengu exposed their culture bacteria to viruses, killing most of the bacteria. But when they repeatedly cultured the surviving bacteria and introduced the same viruses, the bacteria got progressively better at fighting them off. The bacteria had, in effect, developed an immunity to the viruses, just like we get immunity to chickenpox after an exposure. Just as Vergniaud and Bulletin had predicted, understanding where these CRISPR repeats came from and how they functioned forced researchers to look far back into the deep history of microbial life on Earth. Although the battle between virus and bacteria had been going on for a long time, scientists didn't know much about how it was playing out until new genome sequencing tools made a deeper level of scrutiny possible. The discovery of CRISPR came at the intersection of genome sequencing and big data analytics. The heroes of CRISPR were code breakers cracking the genetic code for how the bacteria defended itself. A CRISPR is like an Old West Most Wanted poster of a virus that a bacterium stores in its own genetic code after an initial exposure. The bacteria archives fragments of the viral DNA from these past exposures into the bacteria's own genetic code to create a series of genetic mugshots of bad guy viruses. If the virus rolls into cellular town, the bacteria sends an RNA probe to search for code in the virus's DNA that matches the stored genetic CRISPR target list. When it finds one, the bacteria uses an enzyme to bind to the virus's matching code and cut apart the viral DNA just at the site where the bacterial and viral codes match. When this works, the viral attackers are cut to pieces, the bacteria survive the attack, the piano starts up again, and the saloon customers go back to their card games. But this story isn't just about viruses and bacteria. Because some bacteria merged into the cells of most other life forms hundreds of millions of years ago, the genetic code that originally stemmed from the ongoing war between viruses and bacteria became replicated in nearly all cells across the spectrum of life. CRISPR, it turned out, held the key to potentially editing the code of all life and changing biological life as we know it. As more researchers began to explore the science of CRISPR, big strides in understanding this remarkable new tool came fast and furious. In 2010, Sylvain Moineau and his colleagues showed how the CRISPR-Cas9, for CRISPR-associated gene number 9, system made double-stranded breaks in DNA at predictable and precise locations. The following year, Emmanuel Charpentier figured out how small bits of two different types of RNA guide the Cas9 enzyme to its target. Then the following year, in 2012, Charpentier and her new partner, Berkeley biochemist Jennifer Doudna, as well as Martin Jinnick, cleverly adapted the CRISPR-Cas9 system into a precise tool that could be harnessed to cut any strand of DNA. They also figured out how the system could be used to insert additional new DNA. After being cut, the DNA tries to rebind where the cut has been made and will grab the available DNA researchers have positioned to fit into the opening. This made the gene editing process far easier than ever before. The following year, Doudna, Charpentier, and Harvard MIT researcher Feng Zhang announced that CRISPR-Cas9 could be used to target multiple locations in the human genome at once. If we had to summarize CRISPR into a single sentence, it would be this: CRISPR systems deploy the same tiny scissors bacteria use to cut up attacking viruses to snip any genetic code in a targeted place and potentially insert new genetic code. The CRISPR-Cas9 system is such a big deal because it has huge advantages over the older gene editing approaches. While the ZFN and TALENs are bespoke systems taking months to design, the CRISPR technology is almost entirely always the same, takes less than a few days to set up, and costs relatively little. But despite these overwhelming strengths, the CRISPR system has its shortcomings. Slicing the double strand of DNA using CRISPR was significantly more precise than with ZNF or TALEN, but such an aggressive cut opened the door for even greater unintended effects. While the scientific world and the popular media were swooning over CRISPR-Cas9, a steady stream of advances was making abundantly clear both that CRISPR-Cas9 was even more versatile than previously understood, and that it was not the last word in precision gene editing, but just the beginning. Rather than an equivalent to scissors, the CRISPR system is now looking more like a versatile Swiss Army knife, able to record genetic changes within a cell over time, identify specific virus strains, test for infections, spatially reorganize the genome, and perform a host of other functions. Another approach pioneered by the Broad Institute's Feng Zhang pairs CRISPR with a different enzyme, Cas13, to edit the messenger RNA to help better target where cuts and changes to the genome can be made. Scientists are also now using CRISPR not just to change the genes, but also to alter the epigenetic marks dictating how the genes are expressed. Although early skeptics of human gene editing correctly warned that epigenetic influences on the expression of genes made effective gene editing a lot more complicated than first understood, recent advances have made clear that epigenetic editing is on the verge of reprogramming gene expression at will. As the rate of change in gene editing is accelerating, the process is being made cheaper and more precise, and the globally networked community of scientists is sharing ideas at a level and speed that would have been unthinkable, not just to a relatively isolated monk like Gregor Mendel, but also to some of the world's most sophisticated scientists only a decade ago. The step-by-step progression from basic plant and animal experiments and applications to increasingly substantial human uses is already underway. The first phase of normalization of precision gene editing involves using these tools to advance basic research. One of the most significant early benefits of CRISPR-Cas9 is its ability to target and isolate for study specific DNA sequences. By using the molecular scissors of Cas9 enzyme to quickly, easily, and cheaply cut a specific DNA sequence, scientists can study the effect of a compromised gene on cells and organisms. This is a huge deal for scientific research that is increasingly being translated into real-world applications on plants, laboratory and farm animals, and preliminarily, humans. A plant pathologist at Pennsylvania State University, for example, used CRISPR to target a whole family of genes that encodes polyphenol oxidase, PPO, an enzyme responding to oxidation. The gene-edited Arctic apple can be sliced and left out in the open without browning because scientists have used CRISPR to silence a gene controlling production of an enzyme that causes apples to brown. A virus-resistant rainbow papaya gene, edited to avoid the devastating papaya ring spot virus, is already in supermarkets, as is the bruise-resistant innate potato. Del Monte has received approval to gene-edit a pink pineapple modified to contain more of the antioxidant lycopene than regular pineapples. A waxy corn that makes better cornstarch, wheat with a higher fiber and lower gluten content, tomatoes better able to grow in warm climates, and camelina with enhanced omega-3 fatty acids are all on the way thanks to CRISPR technology. In our yogurt and in plants like these, we humans are already bringing CRISPR-edited genes into our bodies. Gene-editing crops isn't just about keeping our mushrooms from browning and our potatoes from bruising. This technology also has the potential to protect billions of dollars of crops and save the lives of millions of the world's poorest people. In Africa and South Asia, where huge percentages of the population are subsistence farmers, average temperatures are warming, and populations are expanding, this need is particularly stark. Using gene editing to create new, more resilient, faster-growing varieties of rice and other crops that need less water could, in the words of Microsoft founder and philanthropist Bill Gates, be a lifesaver on a massive scale. Gene editing tools are also being used aggressively on animals. In addition to generating the gene-edited laboratory rats and mice for biological research, CRISPR is being used to alter the genes and gene expressions of a menagerie of other animals. The Gates Foundation, for example, is supporting efforts by the Global Alliance for Livestock Veterinary Medicines to create genetically modified super cows that can withstand very hot temperatures while producing much more milk than traditional cows. One scientist whose daughter is allergic to eggs is using CRISPR-Cas9 to engineer hypoallergenic chicken eggs. Researchers are using CRISPR to genetically engineer virus-resistant and faster-growing pigs and parasite-resistant and hornless cattle, which could save commercial ranchers hundreds of millions of dollars per year. On a less practical level, China's BGI Shenzhen created micro-pigs designed to be lab animals or pets that grow to a maximum of 33 pounds, 1/17 of the weight of an average adult pig. Harvard's George Church is even exploring the possibility of using CRISPR and industrial-scale multiplex automated genome engineering tools to revive the extinct woolly mammoth by simultaneously altering multiple genes of Asian elephant embryos. Woolly mammoths notwithstanding, accommodating gene-edited plants and animals in our food supply and homes will create a greater level of acceptance of gene editing more generally. The incredible promise of gene editing tools to treat and cure diseases will propel social acceptance of the technologies even more. Although this book is about the heritable genetic alterations that will ultimately transform our species, The path from here to that future will pass through the application of non-heritable genetic therapies to treat diseases and improve healthcare. Transforming our evolutionary process is the ultimate destination of the genetics revolution, but medicine will be an essential way station on the road from where we are now to where we are inevitably going. When the possibility of altering a living human's genes to treat disease was introduced in the 1980s, it was recognized as a potential, but far-off, game-changer. Over the ensuing years, the possibility of manipulating genes to prevent or treat multiple diseases has become an increasingly real possibility. Instead of the more traditional methods of treating diseases with surgery or drugs, gene therapies seek to use genes to treat or prevent disease by knocking out or turning off a mutated gene, replacing a mutated gene with a healthy copy of the same gene, and/or adding a new gene to help the body fight a particular disease. As exciting as all this sounds and is, the path toward realizing gene therapies in healthcare has been a rocky one. By 1999, doctors at the University of Pennsylvania were confident the science of gene therapy had advanced enough that it could be used to treat Jesse Gelsinger, an 18-year-old with ornithine transcarbamylase, OTC, deficiency, a rare genetic disorder that causes increased ammonia levels in the blood, often leading to brain damage and premature death. 4 days after receiving an infusion of a corrective OTC gene delivered in a manipulated cold virus, Gelsinger died. Jesse Gelsinger's death was not just a personal and family tragedy. It also put a screeching halt to the application of gene therapies to treat disease in America, then by far the leading venue for these technologies in the world. The FDA prohibited the University of Pennsylvania from continuing its human gene therapy trials, began investigating 69 other ongoing gene therapy trials in the United States, and started requiring a far higher level of patient safety for gene therapy trials. But with the prospect of gene therapy slowed, researchers got to work developing better and safer gene transfer protocols. As gene editing techniques improved in the ensuing years, so did the prospects for gene therapy. By 2009, the journal Science declared the return of gene therapy as the major breakthrough of the year, and the more recent development of better gene editing tools like CRISPR have only made the future of gene therapies seem even brighter. Although many gene therapy protocols are now being actively explored, one of the most exciting and widely covered in the media is genetically enhancing the ability of a person's T cells, white blood cells that play an essential role in the body's natural immune response. In CAR-T therapy, blood cells are extracted from the body of a person with specific cancers and then engineered to boost the ability of their T cells to express a chimeric antigen receptor, CAR, before being put back into the person's body with cancer-fighting superpowers. In the first 3 months of clinical trials of this approach by the pharmaceutical company Novartis in 2017, 83% of patients showed a significant remission rate in their cancers. Billions of investment dollars are now flowing into scores of companies like Novartis, Gilead, Juno Therapeutics, Celgene, and Servier that are working on gene therapies for cancer, and many hundreds of clinical trials are running around the world. CAR-T therapy still has some significant challenges, and a small number of people have even died during clinical trials. But there is no doubt removing, editing, and reintroducing genes will play a greater role in fighting cancer and other diseases going forward. As of August 2018, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration had received more than 700 applications for gene therapy trials. Removing cells from the body to edit and return them in gene therapy is a massive step forward. But an even bigger advance is our growing ability to use CRISPR and other tools to edit the offending cells still inside the body. Editing cells inside the body would open a whole new set of possibilities, not only for treating disease, but also potentially for gene editing human embryos. A recent study, for example, gene-edited cells to treat diseased human livers grown inside living mice. Another study used CRISPR base editors to precisely correct genetic mutations causing a metabolic liver disease in adult mice. These types of in vivo gene therapies are not yet ready for prime time, but is showing promising early results in potentially treating congenital blindness, hemophilia B, beta thalassemia, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, cystic fibrosis, and spinal muscular atrophy. Incredible new companies like Editas, co-founded by George Church, Feng Zhang, and others, and Caribou Biosciences, co-founded by Jennifer Doudna, and others, are moving forward aggressively to develop new ways of treating multiple diseases with CRISPR gene editing. A 44-year-old man in California in November 2017 became the first person to have genes edited inside his body, in this case to treat the metabolic disease Hunter syndrome. Responding to this progress, the FDA and National Institutes of Health jointly announced in August 2018 that they would significantly reduce the special oversight processes for gene therapies because there is no longer sufficient evidence to claim that the risks of gene therapy are entirely unique and unpredictable, or that the field still requires special oversight that falls outside our existing framework for ensuring safety. This rapid coming of age of gene therapies is being matched by other developments pushing the gene editing revolution forward. A Silicon Valley startup named Synthigo, for example, sells custom CRISPR-edited human and other cell lines delivered to researchers within days. Another company, Inscripta, is trying to make all of the tools needed for CRISPR just an easy click away. These new companies, Wired noted in May 2018, are betting that biology will be the next great computing platform, DNA will be the code that runs it, and CRISPR will be the programming language. Although the current generation of genetic healthcare interventions is not passed on to future generations of the people being treated, the popular acceptance of and demand for these treatments will play an important role making the general public more comfortable with the concept of human genetic alteration. It would be impossible to capture in this or any book the breadth and speed of the experimental advances with major healthcare implications using precision gene editing being made almost daily, but here are a few examples of the intensifying stream of progress made in recent years alone. In 2013, researchers in the Netherlands used CRISPR-Cas9 on human stem cells to repair a defect that contributes to the appearance of cystic fibrosis. In 2014, scientists used CRISPR-Cas9 to correct liver cells in mice, modeling the human disease hereditary tyrosinemia. In 2015, researchers deployed CRISPR-Cas9 to edit endogenous beta-globin genes in human cells which, when mutated, result in beta-thalassemia blood disorders. In 2016, scientists used CRISPR-Cas9 to extract HIV from human immune cell DNA and prevent the reinfection of unedited cells. In 2017, researchers first used CRISPR-Cas9 on a human embryo successfully to correct a defect in the MYBPC3 gene that causes hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. In 2018, scientists showed how a novel CRISPR gene editing technique could potentially correct most of the 3,000 mutations causing Duchenne muscular dystrophy by cutting single points along a patient's DNA. In 2019, researchers showed how CRISPR-Cas9 could be combined with special guide RNA to more accurately than ever before edit human cells to correct the genetic mutation causing sickle cell disease. Because these breakthroughs are happening so rapidly as ideas and innovations cross-fertilize, it is certain that more CRISPR miracles will be announced after the final edits of this book are submitted. It is also certain that new gene editing tools more precise than CRISPR will arrive in the coming years. Gene therapy will become a mainstay in treating, and maybe curing, many of our most devastating and intractable diseases, FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb presciently declared in 2018. Getting comfortable with editing people's cells to cure terrible diseases will provide a level of comfort with and confidence in our ability to use CRISPR and other tools to precisely and safely edit the human genome. As this comfort level increases, scientists, doctors, and prospective parents will begin to ask why these tools can't also be used to prevent these diseases in the first place. Mitochondria are the tiny power packs of the cell. Floating in the cell's cytoplasm, if the cell were an egg, the nucleus would be the yolk and the cytoplasm the white. They are the legacy of symbiotic bacteria incorporated into our cells hundreds of millions of years ago. Nearly all our 21,000 or so genes are located in the cell's nucleus, but a far smaller number, just 37, are in the mitochondria. Unlike nuclear DNA, which is the combination of the DNA from both parents, mitochondrial DNA, mtDNA, is passed almost entirely from mother to child. Most people have healthy mitochondria that allow their body to get the energy it needs from their cells. But about 1 in 200 people has a disease-causing mtDNA mutation, and about 1 in 6,500 develop symptoms of mitochondrial disease. These dangerous mutations primarily target children, who often suffer systemic organ failure. The symptoms generally get more severe with age and can increasingly damage cells in the brain, liver, heart, and other bodily systems. If everyone with mitochondrial disease died young, this disease would have been eradicated from the human gene pool long ago. But a mother's mitochondrial problems tend to be distributed unevenly among her offspring, allowing some of the children to live healthy lives, others to live managing the diseases, and others to die terrible early deaths. For millennia, parents with mitochondrial disease had no idea why their children were suffering. They blamed fate. But fate was not a good enough answer for the Swedish endocrinologist Dr. Rolf Luft, who first diagnosed a patient with mitochondrial disease in 1962. Although huge progress was made in understanding mitochondrial disease in the early years, little was achieved in finding a cure or preventing it from being passed mother to child. In the 1990s, Jacques Cohen and his colleagues at the Institute for Reproductive Medicine and Science in New Jersey pioneered a process of injecting fluid from the cytoplasm of a healthy egg into an egg where problems in the cytoplasm were believed to be causing infertility. Although 17 babies born through this procedure were mitochondrial disease-free, 2 fetuses indicated a severe genetic disorder. In response, the FDA in 2001 started requiring clinics to apply for approval to carry out the procedure. Because of the imperfect safety record, few applied. No approvals were granted. Nevertheless, the underlying science continued to advance. Over the past decade, teams in the United Kingdom and the United States developed 2 new mitochondrial transfer procedures. In one, the healthy nucleus taken from an egg of the intended mother carrying faulty mitochondria is removed and placed inside the denucleated egg of a donor woman without mitochondrial disease. It's like keeping the egg yolk but replacing the white with a donated one. In the other procedure, the same process happens to the early-stage embryo after the egg is fertilized. Scientists remove the nucleus and place it into the denucleated embryo donor parents provide. As prospective mothers carrying mitochondrial disease learned of this new approach, many were interested, but some observers were worried. Mitochondrial transfer is a heritable treatment. A daughter born with donor mitochondria will pass that mitochondrial DNA to her daughter and down the line forever. This is why women who get their ancestral history through DNA tests can learn about their mother's 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 mother all the way back to our human female common ancestor, mitochondrial Eve, from around 160,000 years ago. Even though the total amount of donor DNA in a child born with the mitochondrial transfer treatment would be small, scientifically altering human DNA for all future generations is a big deal. The United Kingdom has done more than any other country to thoughtfully consider mitochondrial therapies and their implications. Soon after the test tube miracle baby, Louise Brown, was born in Manchester in 1978, the United Kingdom created a committee of inquiry into human fertilization and embryology. The committee produced a major 1984 report on the future of assisted reproduction, and then a 1987 white paper outlining a legislative agenda for going forward. This critically important work culminated in the 1990 Human Fertilization and Embryology Act that created, you guessed it, the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority, HFEA. Since then, the FHEA has done incredible work overseeing and regulating reproductive technologies across Britain. Although the 1990 Act didn't consider, and therefore couldn't expressly authorize, mitochondrial therapies, the issue was raised in 2010 when researchers asked the UK Department of Health and Social Care to amend its regulations to allow mitochondrial transfer. Rather than just considering this a simple regulatory decision, the UK government launched an intensive 5-year consultation process, including a series of expert panels, public forums, comment opportunities on draft legislation, and cost-benefit analyses by the Department of Health. In 2015, the issue of whether the HFEA should be allowed to authorize clinical trials was put to a full vote of both Houses of Parliament and passed unanimously. The HFEA then waited for results from additional studies and convened even more expert panels on the safety and efficacy of these procedures. In March 2017, Britain's HFEA granted its first license to doctors to use the mitochondrial transfer technique on a human embryo to be implanted in prospective mothers. After the first two clinical applications were approved on February 1, 2018, the first British child born using mitochondrial transfer will all but certainly be delivered in 2019. Moving forward with this first-ever case of state-sponsored heritable genetic engineering was a monumental step not just for the United Kingdom, but also for humanity, and the British handled the process responsibly. In America, the process of considering mitochondrial transfer has been much more bureaucratic. The FDA effectively banned mitochondrial transfer in a 2001 extension of its authorities, and then in 2016, Congress forbade the FDA from even authorizing clinical trials of mitochondrial replacement therapy. Although a series of expert panels on the issue have been held, the FDA has yet to authorize clinical trials, partly because the contentious politics of abortion in the United States makes any discussion of manipulating embryos extremely complicated. Even after a 2016 U.S. National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine report concluded that some limited application of mitochondrial transfer treatments could be justified for male embryos, to make sure no genetic changes could be passed on to future generations, the effective U.S. ban on mitochondrial transfer treatments remains in place. But before the first British license was granted, and while the procedure was still banned in the United States, a Jordanian couple approached New York-based physician John Zhang about having it done. Because mitochondrial transfer was still illegal in the United States, Zhang agreed to travel to Mexico, which at the time had no rules governing the procedure. By the time this birth was officially announced in September 2016, The Jordanian baby was already a healthy 5 month old. Zhang returned to New York without repercussion and soon announced the creation of his new company, aptly named Darwin Life, which he described as pushing the boundaries of assisted reproductive technology. In January 2017, doctors in Ukraine transferred the nucleus of an early-stage embryo with mitochondrial disease to a denucleated donor embryo without it, resulting in the birth of another healthy baby. Potential mothers who carry mitochondrial disease in the few places where mitochondrial transfer is allowed have a full range of options. Of course, they can always adopt, but if they want to have a fully biologically related child, they have the option of rolling the dice by getting pregnant, testing the embryo after 10 weeks of pregnancy, and facing the option of abortion. Or they can just have the child and see if their naturally born and unscreened children will be born with a deadly form of mitochondrial disease. An alternative option would be for the mother to have her eggs extracted and fertilized using IVF and then genetically screened with PGT. But mitochondrial disease does not fully show up in early-stage embryos, so an embryo screened prior to implantation could still be a carrier of mitochondrial disease. If a mother in one of these jurisdictions wanted to be certain her child would not carry mitochondrial disease, she could swap out the cytoplasm of her egg prior to insemination during IVF, or of her early-stage embryo just after the egg was fertilized, all for the price of 0.1% of the child's total DNA becoming inherited from the mitochondrial donor. But what about women living in parts of the world where mitochondrial transfer is banned or unavailable? They can adopt too. Of course, they can roll the hereditary dice. They can also do IVF and PGT if they are in a jurisdiction where that is legal, but they would still run the risk of passing the disease to future generations. They can travel to a place like Ukraine, but that's expensive, uncomfortable, and inconvenient. Another option would be to band together with other prospective parents with the disease to form a lobby group to try to make mitochondrial transfer legal at home. That's exactly what the mitochondrial disease community has done in the United States. We strongly support further scientific investigation of oocyte MRT, mitochondrial replacement therapy, as well as constructive debate towards the clinical approval of this therapy in women with mtDNA-related diseases, the Pittsburgh-based United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation, UMDF, publicly declared. If demonstrated to be safe and efficacious, this technique should be made available as an option to families who carry mtDNA point mutations. As evidence of the safety and efficacy of mitochondria transfer in places like the United Kingdom continues to grow, pressure on other governments to fund research and ultimately allow heritable mitochondrial therapies by advocacy groups in those countries will increase. Politicians in those countries will have a hard time telling mothers terrified of passing potentially deadly mitochondrial disease to their children and influential single-issue lobby groups that they can't have access to the mitochondrial replacement procedure that has been proven safe and effective under the highest level of government scrutiny in the United Kingdom. Over time, mitochondrial transfer will likely become the first relatively widely accepted heritable genetic manipulation. Once this happens, parents afraid of passing other deadly genetic diseases to their future children will not sit by idly while their future children face potential genetic death sentences. Instead, they will demand that the most advanced precision gene editing technologies be used to make the targeted changes that will save their future children from suffering. As scientists continue to provide an increasing set of new potential possibilities to gene-edit embryos to prevent disease and enhance health, parental demand will only increase. Almost every significant genetic disease has its own social network, and many also have politically influential lobby groups. Disease advocacy groups spend many millions of dollars annually lobbying the U.S. government. Each $1,000 invested in this type of outreach is estimated to correlate to a $25,000 increase the following year in National Institutes of Health funding for a specific disease. It is hard to imagine the U.S. government, itself driven largely by the interests of special interest pressure groups, not eventually supporting research into and clinical trials of the most promising treatments for genetic diseases, even those that involve making heritable changes to pre-implanted embryos. The major strides toward making gene editing of pre-implanted human embryos possible will add more fuel to this rocket. In April 2015, scientists from Sun Yat-sen University in Guangzhou, China, shocked the world by disclosing they had used CRISPR-Cas9 to genetically alter genes in human embryos in vitro linked to the often fatal blood disorder beta thalassemia. The embryos were non-viable because they had been fertilized by two sperm cells instead of the usual one, and the accuracy rate of the edits was dismal. But this first reported direct application of CRISPR to the nuclear DNA of human embryos crossed an ethical Rubicon in the minds of many observers. Soon after, United Kingdom regulators approved an application by Kathy Neacon, a researcher at London's Francis Crick Institute. Neacon wanted to CRISPR-edit the genes of viable human embryos and examine how a gene called OCT4 regulates the development of fetuses, a first step to better understand a particular cause of infertility. 2 months later, another team of Chinese scientists announced they had used CRISPR to try to make early-stage unimplanted human embryos resistant to HIV. Then, in July 2017, the path-breaking and controversial U.S. scientist Shukrat Mitalipov of Oregon Health and Science University became the first American researcher to use CRISPR-Cas9 to genetically alter human sex cells and unimplanted embryos. Mitalipov injected a CRISPR-Cas9 genetic scissors into the sperm of a man carrying a faulty MYBPC3 gene, which can cause hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, a heritable disease that can lead to sudden heart failure in children. When this gene-edited sperm was used to fertilize the eggs of 12 healthy donor women, 2/3 of the embryos were created disease-free, a big increase over previous efforts. When Mitalipov's team tried the same thing, but only injected the unedited sperm and the CRISPR-Cas9 separately, so that the sperm editing happened simultaneous to egg fertilization, the success rate increased to 72%. 72% efficacy is still not nearly good enough, and the embryos were all destroyed within 3 days, but a marker had clearly been set down on the path to the heritable gene editing of nuclear DNA in humans. We've always said in the past gene editing shouldn't be done, mostly because it couldn't be done safely, MIT researcher Richard Hines told the New York Times after Mitalipov's findings were released. That's still true, but now it looks like it's going to be done safely soon. When this happens, the irresistible attraction of using our most advanced technologies to eliminate our most deadly diseases will draw us into the genetic age. The amazingly rapid transfer of advanced gene editing tools from laboratories to farms and ranches, and then to our hospitals and fertility clinics, is already well underway with a momentum of its own. Almost every day, a new application is announced that, once available, some group of humans will demand. The very real benefits of these technologies to a growing group of potential beneficiaries will eventually outweigh the abstract aspirations of a dwindling number of genetic traditionalists. But as we increasingly master and grow comfortable with this technology, we'll create a process with applications extending far beyond healthcare, which we'll use to alter the genetics of ourselves and our children in increasingly significant ways.